Public sentiment on returning declined asylum applicants and migrants holding irregular status has been dominant in Europe, even across the Atlantic. The conversations on return has steered many EU member states' politics, all while the larger issue of migration has driven elections globally. While in theory, return is a straightforward process, often it's not very simple. Returning people home can get very complicated. Today, we will unpack the complex issue of return and reintegration. Two of our senior experts on the matter will give us a deep and comprehensive look, yet in a simple way, how ICMPD and its partners are navigating the technicalities, the politics, the nuances, and even the logistics of return. Joining us today, we have Dries Lensen, EU Return and Reintegration Portfolio Manager for ICMPD. Thank you, Dries, for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Also with us today is Peter Nealon, Senior Project Manager for the Return and Reintegration Programme. Hi, Peter. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, well, Mike, thanks for having me.
Thank you both for joining us. I will just dig in, beginning with asking you to introduce us to the Return and Reintegration Facility and how it all came about and why was it established?
Thank you so much, Mike. The RRF, which stands for the Return and Reintegration Facility, which is a project implemented by ICMPD since 2022, and its end date is 2026, that supports member states in return and reintegration. Effectively, what we're doing is helping them in enhancing their technical and operational capacities, enhancing effectiveness of return and reintegration processes, and at the same time also contributing to the policies of the European Union, in particular the EU strategy on voluntary return and reintegration. We do this by supporting them financially, but also operationally. But one thing that's really important to highlight, we have to make sure that everything is aligned with broader EU migration policies. When we talk today about return and reintegration, RRF is not just another facility. It's a part of a strategic shift towards smarter, more coordinated, and more sustainable migration management across the EU member states as well as in partner countries.
Thanks, Dries. That's a bit more on the technical level, and we will get into that later on in more comprehensive approach. But for now, just to go through the concept of it all, could you tell us a bit more about the broader context of EU migration policy today and how are we able to support this?
It's important that to note that the RRF operates in a multi-stakeholder environment, involving not just EU policymakers, but also at EU at national levels. Return and integration are topics that concern all EU member states, which is why understanding the broader political framework and recent developments is essential to see where the RRF fits and how it supports these efforts. And in fact, there were, over the past few years, clear shifts towards a more Europeanized return and reintegration framework, more towards result-driven approaches, but also towards a stronger accent on voluntary return, on reintegration, on investment in better relations with countries of origin.
Why did we go through such a shift and what triggered this?
Well, one of the big reasons that were communicated by the EU and its member states is that return rates have remained low. And cooperation with partner countries continues to be a challenge when it comes to return, reintegration, but also readmission.
When we say low return rates, meaning with the number, against the number of people who have to be returned for different reasons,
exactly,
not a lot has been accomplished. Exactly. Is that what we mean
exactly.
here?
Exactly. We mean the number of people that have received a decision to return versus those who have left the member state effectively. And that is still low, and that is due to a number of reasons. So you might have heard it in the media. I think the politics in the EU have taken a shift. And in response, the EU and the member state have stepped up their capacities, investing more funds, more staffing, and there is also more political will, especially in strengthening voluntary return and reintegration. And I want to highlight two key developments here. First, the EU has reinforced its agencies to ensure that return and reintegration can be done for all the member states. And here I want to give the example of Frontex, the European Border and Coast Guard Agency, which received an enhanced mandate in 2019, giving them the mandate to support voluntary returns and also reintegration. Secondly, and that happened in 2021, the Commission launched its EU strategy on voluntary return and reintegration, which is part of a broader package, which is the EU Pact on Migration and Asylum. This was the first time that the Commission launched a specific document on a strategy that put voluntary returns and reintegration in the front. And that's really changed the way of thinking towards return and reintegration. And it's here where the return and reintegration facility, which was established in 2022, sets in. We're supporting member states in building more effective and common return systems. But at the same time, we're also fostering and deepening cooperation with countries of origin. And it's that investment in sustainable reintegration, making sure that return isn't just about, you know, leaving the EU, because I think that is what sometimes the perception is. So it's definitely about helping migrants reintegrate in their societies and giving them a real chance to rebuild their lives back home. At the same time, current legislative proposals, such as the EU return regulation, which is under debate right now, the member states are going to face real pressure to deliver. And just to show how important that is, President von der Leyen from the Commission made in her State of the Union a very clear message. The return systems need to be humane, but they also need to be effective. And that's exactly where our work comes in. And it's not just about implementing that, but it's also standing beside our member states with tools, with expertise, with data, with partnerships that they'll need to navigate this chapter. Because, Mike, let's be honest, returns are no longer just a technical issue. They serve as a litmus test for how Europe manages migration forward.
Return really is indeed a highly sensitive and political topic, as you've just outlined. Could we go through how return procedures work in the European Union?
There are some nuances when it comes to the implementation, whether it's a voluntary return or there is a non-voluntary return.
Non-voluntary is forced.
Yes, indeed. And these procedures are guided by a common legislative framework, which is the EU Return Directive, adopted in 2008. This framework is transposed in national law, and member states have to follow those rules accordingly. But the EU is now moving further with the EU Pact on Migration and Asylum and the upcoming return regulation, which was proposed in March this year. The goal is to streamline and harmonize the processes even more across member states.
Could we go through the process?
Everything starts when a person is in the EU without a legal basis to stay. And that can happen for a number of reasons. It might follow a rejected asylum request, or it can follow after an expired visa. Each case is different. So there is not just something like illegal stay. What happens then is that the member state will issue a return decision. What is a return decision? It's a decision by the state that confirms that the person has exhausted all legal paths to remain in the EU and that he or she need to leave the member states. What happens then is the counseling and the voluntary return options. And this is a key moment. Migrants need to be informed about their return options. And here it's very crucial that they are well aware of the voluntary return options. And it's return counseling that plays a crucial role. Member states, often now supported by the EU or by international organizations such as ICPD, but also by civil society organizations, offer tailored advice and reintegration assistance. And here is where the EU strategy on voluntary return and reintegration sets in. The EU made an initiative to really elevate the importance on voluntary return and on counseling. And it pushed for more investment in this area, both in terms of capacities, but also in making the process more accessible and humane. So once a person receives a return decision, ideally the migrant is informed about options and guided towards possibilities of return. So return counseling can never be understood as a push towards return, but rather to ensure that migrants are informed about the possibilities of return. Because voluntary return is and will always be the preferred option over a non-voluntary return or forced return, as you mentioned. Why? Because voluntary return is more humane. It's more cost-effective, obviously, than forced return. Forced return is a highly sensitive operation. Then there is one crucial element, and that's the readmission and the travel arrangements. To return, you need travel documents to board a plane. And it happens that a person has lost identity documents. And then there is a need to start up identification processes with the authorities of the countries of origin. And that happens on different levels. It happens through bilateral agreements to ensure that countries of origin can deliver emergency travel documents. And here, sometimes there is a challenge. Some lack those documents. Sometimes there is a hesitation in collaboration. This is where also we are relying very much on partners to help the readmission to be effective as possible.
And then the actual return itself happens.
Yes, and then the actual return happens. And the return that can happen by air, by land, by sea. But most of the time it happens by an airplane. And as I said, voluntary return is always the preferred option because it aligns with EU laws, it aligns with international standards. Non-voluntary return, on the other hand, is used as a last resort. And as I said, it's a complex operation that requires well-trained staff. It's crucial that fundamental rights are respected. Ideally, all forced returns are monitored independently to ensure that they're done lawfully and respectfully.
We'll get to a bit more detail on that later on. But just to go with the flow, what happens on their arrival in their home countries?
The last step of a return is the post-arrival and post-return assistance, which is also referred as reintegration assistance. And this is where the person arrives in the country of origin, and it does not mean that it ends there. It actually continues. Reintegration assistance is always tailored to each returnee, providing to help them in rebuilding their lives. And depending on the case, this can include financial support, a cash grant, for example, but it could also include accommodation, housing, vocational training, psychosocial support, in every form that is tailored to the needs of the returnee to ensure that he or she can reintegrate back into society. The RRF has developed projects, integration projects, in a number of partner countries where we offer kinds of support to returnees. And reintegration is a complex matter. Sometimes it's more complex than the return itself, and it requires a solid coordination between member states, partners, countries of origin, actors, and so on.
Well, this all sounds very organized and also very complex. But at the same time, it all sounds very tedious, especially when it comes to the documentation and record keeping, which I may add could involve very sensitive information of the returnees themselves. And even at the political level, the process that has been taken, the actors involved, the journey itself, everything is sensitive. Not to mention our strict adherence to data protection and respect for people's right to privacy. How do we manage all of these?
Indeed, this is a crucial element in the return process. Until recently, many return processes involved a lot of paperwork and manual management through emails, spreadsheets, but things are changing. And this is also why we will very soon have more information about what the return digitalization will look like. Allow me to give you one clear example, and that's the reintegration assistance tool, RIAD. It helps to streamline the entire return reintegration journey from the counseling in the EU to follow-up support to returnees in the countries of origin, while ensuring what you were mentioning, data protection safeguards. So while return may sound like a simple concept on paper, it's in reality it's a highly structured and very sensitive process. One that involves legal, logistical, human, but now also digital components. And the trend is clear, making it more humane, making it more coherent, and more harmonized, but also more effective, both for authorities in the member states, but also those organizations managing that process. And at the core of that, making sure that returnees benefit the most.
Peter, let me turn to you. How does this work exactly? And it perhaps also, as Dries mentioned earlier, the technical and legal aspects of data protection.
RIAD stands for Reintegration Assistance Tool. It's a digital platform that is basically created to help manage individual reintegration assistance in a, if I call it, smart, efficient way. It's part of EU's broader push to digitalize return procedures, make it all more effective across member states. RIAD is owned and governed by the European Commission, so the role of RRF, the role of ICMPD, is ensure, support its day-to-day implementation, further development, also support member states in using it. And that is linked to that, call it, horizontal policy objective to harmonize return and reintegration. So basically have one and the same way in Europe on how you process reintegration support. And focus has long been mostly on harmonization, means everybody gives the same packages, gives the same type of support. So harmonization is not only giving the same assistance, it's also processing the assistance in the same way. All member states speaking the same language, working along the same logic, using the same timelines so that support is predictable for a migrant from whichever European member state he comes from. And basically this kind of like insight that has developed, say, over the last decade, kind of, when member states started to work more and more together on the issue of reintegration, led to RIAD. RIAD as a standard process flow. It's developed in such a way that it allows flexibility so that every member state can do the things more or less on their own way, but still all following the same pattern. Basically, and I think that's one of the unique features of that platform, RIAD is an open platform. It's not only for member state administrations, as you might spontaneously think. I mean, it's about return, so you only have member state administrations. Basically, RIAD is open to all different, call it, stakeholders that work on an individual reintegration case. And that starts with a counselor in a member state. Certain member states that are, let's say, state officials, member state counselors. In other member states, it are people working for NGOs, civil society organizations, whatever. So they enter that platform, they work directly in that platform. But then basically there's also the other side, the post-arrival side, so reintegration partners, organizations basically receiving people after their return, providing the assistance, implementing reintegration projects, they have direct access as well to RIAD. So basically they get the information about the persons that come back, that get back, and that they will have to assist. They get that information before the person is back, so they know what's awaiting them. They document the reintegration plan, so how they will support the person. They document basically the result of the reintegration project. So basically it's all in the same system, it all follows the same process logic, and again, and I think that is really a unique feature, it is open basically for everybody who is instrumental in working in a case. This open character allows a return counselor in a member state basically to keep track of the work he or she started, which is counseling a person, talking about the possibility of return, the feasibility of return. Basically, they can follow what's happening with their, call it, client or the person they counseled all the way until the end of the process. And I think this is something not to be underestimated, because for a counselor, it is difficult. I mean, you have to counsel a person about the reality you do not know, which is the reality in a country of origin. And just by giving that possibility, this window basically to look into what's happening post-arrival, I think that is not to be underestimated.
So it is indeed a game changer. That is indeed a very unique platform, Peter. And also, it would be good to have our listeners understand better how the system works, the steps that are being taken from step one to completion. Could you walk us through very briefly about that?
When we started designing this, our basic assumption was that, okay, there is a huge variety in reintegration projects, in ways how reintegration is processed, but there must be elements that you find in every reintegration process. And this is how we looked basically at what exists. out of that thinking, a certain picture emerged of a reintegration process that goes through three separate distinct phases. And we gave that the name key moments in Riyadh. So basically three key moments. The first one, we're still in the pre-departure stage, is counseling. And that is the moment when a counselor provides information, talks with a person about needs, about possibilities. This is also the moment that what we then call reintegration entitlements are decided, like what's the package, what's the amount, how can it be spent, etc., etc. So all these practicalities are discussed and agreed at that point. All that information is entered in the system, it's validated by the member state, and it is transferred to the reintegration partner that will be there on the other side when a person returns. Key moment two is about the reintegration plan. Basically, reintegration partner meets the person, they discuss, and they agree more or less how to work with the package that person got to support its reintegration. Again, all that information is uploaded in the system and becomes, as I just said, visible for the return counselor. So basically, they see what happened with their preparatory work. The last phase, the third key moment, is then basically a final report. The reintegration partner wraps up what happened and try to document the result of what they did with the reintegration package. Now we have more or less 30,000 individual cases somewhere in that process between key moment one and between key moment three. So that's quite a volume. 30,000 persons all documented in that system in the same way. So you can imagine how much data basically you can get out of Riyadh about reintegration dynamics, impact, results, projects, etc., etc. So that I think is another important element. I mean, the learning potential of Riyadh for Europe about this, I think, fairly important policy topic is huge, and we're just only scratching the surface about what is possible there.
We've talked about how return procedures generally work in the EU, at a general level at least. But I imagine that gets very, very tricky, both when being debated on and agreed in Brussels and when it comes to implementing them domestically in each member state and countries of origin. How do member states differ in their approach? There's probably not one cookie-cutter approach to this, but how do they differ?
Well, all EU member states follow the same return framework. The Return Directive of 2008 is the common legal framework. But how it is implemented, that varies. It is transposed in national law, and then obviously it aligns with national rules, resources, political priorities, and capacities. Not all member states are on the same level when it comes to reintegration support. Some offer comprehensive, full service packages covering things like housing, job placement, training, and psychosocial support. And others stick to the base. So it's up to the member states to decide what level of support they would like to offer.
And as ICMPD, while also working with partners, where do we come in?
Well, that's where international cooperation sets in. Organizations like ICMPD, but also Frontex, which is the EU agency dealing with return, they have clear roles and responsibilities. And our scope of work is to support member states in boosting their capacities and generate also sustainability of return and reintegration. And that is done through technical support, financial support, also training and other kinds of support that are available. But our common goal is the same, supporting member states in making return and integration more effective, more fair and humane.
A lot of these happen within the European Union, or at least at the member states level, right around before the returnee actually gets on that flight home. When they do arrive, what and how do the countries of origin receive? How do they do the work in terms of receiving their citizens back?
It's all about cooperation between member states, between the EU and those countries of origin. Because return doesn't just stop at the border. It heavily depends on good partnerships with countries of origin. When member states or the EU have strong agreements in place on readmission, even on reintegration, it makes a huge difference. It means that returning migrants are more likely to arrive in a context where reintegration assistance is already organized and where the arrival of returnees is managed in a better way. Because then it reduces also the level of stress that is imposed on persons that return back home after potentially being years away, as well as different aspects of return that prevent often the willingness to return. And we'll come back to that a bit later.
Right, this is perhaps a good segue to it. You mentioned the levels of stress that a person experiences throughout the entire process. And I would put myself in the situation of somebody who's potentially or just about to be returned, to go through the whole process. And that is a very distressing prospect after I've been living in that country, or even before that, after I've left my original life back. I must have sold my house, my properties. I might have taken loans. I might have given up on sending my children to school at first just so I could move to Europe and invest for a better life. And then all of a sudden, I'm about to be returned. So going through all of this, it's an emotional, it's a mental limbo. I would probably need a system to help me get through that kind of limbo, not to mention the logistics of what's about to happen. And so one crucial aspect of our work is the role that counseling plays in the return process. I'd really like you to talk about this.
Thanks, Mike. Indeed, return counseling is the crucial element in the return process. And sometimes it's overlooked, unfortunately. And that's why it's so fundamentally important. Returning is difficult, as you mentioned. So it's here where return counseling sets in as a way to make sure that persons are well informed about the options, and that they're in a much better position to make clear, confident decisions about the future. And that in turn helps make the process more predictable. And return counseling is not just something that is available equally in all member states. Until fairly recently, it was done by a lot of international organizations, such as IOM, for example, but also other actors such as civil society organizations. And few member states had their return counseling system in place. But that's changing. And that's a very good development. The EU strategy on voluntary return and reintegration sets in as the policy drive towards more ownership of member states' authorities in investing in return counseling. And it's here where we set in, where the RRF sets in. We have been developing practical tools, tailored materials for different profiles of returnees, because there is not such thing like a one-fits-all. Returning is already stressful enough. So making sure that return counselors can also address those vulnerabilities. These resources now are available for all the member states, and they're made to complement what's already there.
Say I'm being returned to a conflict country, or as a woman, to a country in which my rights are basically non-existent, or as a vulnerable group. All these questions would keep me awake at night. Mm-hmm. And it is very important to have these counseling sessions. But if I would have concerns like that, not only with respect to my well-being or my rights being preserved when I get back home, but also at a technical and legal and even logistical issues, how do our counselors manage these?
First of all, there is a fear of stigma or discrimination once they return to their countries of origin, as migrants may be perceived as a source of loss or as failure. But it's also about what's going to happen when I'm back home. Will I find a job? Will I have a house? And will I be able to contribute to the family's financial integration? So that's a very important aspect to bear in mind. Also, many returning migrants, they worry about whether they will be able to repay their loans or manage family expectations around remittances, which creates then an additional source of stress during the integration process. And in some cases, they're also worried about safety, about security, especially, as you mentioned, in post-conflict areas. And of course, when we're talking about families with children, there is a concern about their children, especially if the children have been born or spent most of their times in the host country. I think there it's where it starts. to really understand each person's situation and address some of the challenges people face, if that is feasible. The second important aspect is that the information needs to be clear and needs to be realistic about reintegration support and what to expect locally. And this implies that the counselor have sufficient knowledge, they have sufficient resources at hand, and if possible, that they have contact with reintegration partners. And for that, it's important that there are trusted local partners involved in the process that can identify at an early stage how the return can take place, how the reintegration should be implemented, and whether they can also connect to the returnees during the process. And reintegration is a process that happens after the return, but it starts at the counseling session. And that's where the counseling is so crucial, to make sure that the reintegration planning is done already in the pre-departure phase, that they can make their decisions. And when they arrive after the return, that the reintegration journey happens as smooth as possible and that it produces long-term results. It's about making sure that they have the right information, the right possibilities, they have access to the right services. But in the end of the day, it's also about human dignity. It's about ensuring that people are empowered, that the return to their countries is not just starting from zero, but that they can conceive it as going home, building up a new story. Counseling doesn't happen on its own. It can only take place if member states actively engage and employ counselors to support returnees before they go back to their countries of origin. But for counselors to do this well, they need to be equipped with proper training, with skill sets, and with the right information. And that means investment. It means giving access to knowledge, practical tools, and guidance on how to handle returnees in different situations. And it's here where the RRF steps in. We have been working for a number of years on tailored tools and materials to support counselors in the EU to have a broader picture, to have more specialized capacities. We have been developing together with the experts in the member states, but also experts from the civil society sector, on topics that relate to empowering women in return, supporting families with children, counseling of migrants facing mental health challenges, but also advanced communication techniques in counseling, like motivational interviewing, trauma-informed counseling, and cultural humility in return counseling. The work is well underway, and we have already delivered quite some training that translate these materials in various member states.
At the EU level, we are talking about over two dozens of member states, and they could have different approaches, different levels of commitment even, different levels of resources and attitudes about this, or at which stage they are. They're never aligned. So are we able to bridge that gap as ICMPD?
Yeah, we have recently launched a new initiative, which is called Support to Frontline Workers. And the idea of that project is quite simple, but it's at the same time also quite powerful. Bring together municipality level actors from different EU countries so that they can share experiences, they can learn from each other, and they can bring those insights back home to improve their own return counseling programs. Because in the end of the day, it's the people on the ground who make the return counseling work. And supporting them means supporting returnees in the most meaningful, humane way possible. There is always the lack of employment or job opportunities, difficulty in finding regular employment or income generating activities that would enable them to reach self-sufficiency. There's also the issue of stigma and acceptance by the communities. As I mentioned earlier, returnees may be seen as a failure by their communities and face discrimination, making the re-establishment of social networks difficult, not only for them, but also for their family members. It's often also a problem in accessing basic services, such as healthcare, education, housing, or social welfare, and the ability to benefit from those systems. And then the last big challenge is the psychological uncertainty.
I'm just going back to the more abstract, if you may call it, part of what we do. And it's no secret that some questions have been raised recently on the process of return, including aspects of human rights, safety, legal concerns, protection, security even. At ICE-NPD, we have been strong on embedding human rights on our projects and even on our policy and research work, the way we conduct research, the way we deal with interviewees, respondents, both in principle and in practice across all of what we do as an organization. How do we ensure human rights standards and safe, dignified returns for the returnees?
Indeed, human rights and safe and dignified returns are at the core of our activities. They are fundamental when it comes to return procedures in the EU. It needs to be ensured that returns are carried out in a safe, dignified and rights-based way at every step of that process. And it's not just about a matter of good practice. It is a legal and ethical obligation. Returnees, they must be in control of their own decisions, and they should be able to count on strong, transparent systems that respect the EU Charter on Fundamental Rights, as well as applicable international law. And member states follow those return procedures. They follow the legal obligations when it comes to fundamental rights and dignified returns. Perhaps allow me to frame it within the return process. Let's have a look first at the return, the pre-return phase. So what happens before the return happens. Sometimes it happens that returnees are placed in administrative detention awaiting their return. And in those cases, the environment must meet international standards. It means proper safeguards, independent monitoring bodies and accountability mechanisms that should be in place. And when the return happens, it's important that the return is monitored from a human rights perspective. And their independent return monitors should be on board to monitor the whole operation, as well as to assist staff on board during the operation. And here, again, the role of independent return monitors is to ensure that human rights are respected throughout the whole process, because oversight indeed matters. And then when the returnees arrive in their countries of origin, it's very crucial to note that it's returning home is not just arriving physically, it's also arriving with safety and with dignity. And here, reintegration support and assistance provided needs to start from the very beginning with the principle that there is no gap. There need to be specialized actors, organizations, institutions that all have a role to play in making sure that returnees get back on their feet. And crucially, the returnees, they need to be well informed of their rights, they need to be well informed about the possibilities and have the right access to robust complaints mechanisms with proper bodies to follow up on those complaints as well.
When the return process has been completed, even at the level of the country of origin, how are we making the process of return and reintegration more sustained, more streamlined, both for the EU and for the countries of origin?
There's a key focus that needs to be taken on board, and that's the local ownership of countries of origin. It means making sure that authorities of countries of origin, that they are involved, and that they can, at a certain point, also take the responsibility of reintegrating their own citizens. And it's here where we are trying to develop a couple of projects where we connect EU stakeholders with counterparts on the ground and making sure that those processes are coordinated in the best possible way. Allow me to give you three examples. At the individual level, we have been implementing a project in Armenia called LOSRA, where we have provided complementary integration services to about 200 returnees to support in their businesses or personal processes. On a community level, because it's also important to support community levels, we have been working closely with the French Office for Immigration and Integration, OFI, where returnees are supported in developing and implementing reintegration programs with a strong accent on environmental components benefiting their communities. And then lastly, on a structural level, we have been investing in initiatives like Prospect in Nigeria, which contributed to bringing together state actors to discuss reintegration initiatives and how these can be embedded in their own national strategies to address migrants with vulnerabilities such as victims of trafficking, which is a very important aspect. So by taking this approach, we ensure that reintegration is streamlined and it truly meets the needs of returnees, but also the communities. And at the same time also that the local actors that are involved and they can take ownership on the long run.
That's a very important point on impact there, because at ICMPD we are also growing in our footprint in terms of community level outreach through our projects globally. As an organization, how are we leveraging this? How are we taking advantage of our presence and our interface with local governments, with host governments, especially those countries of return?
ICMPD is active in a number of countries with different projects. Let me just mention two projects which I mentioned before, the one in Armenia and the one in Nigeria. The LOSRA project in Armenia focuses on two elements. First, it provides the complementary integration assistance to returnees, which is in addition to existing programs provided through the EU or also national programs. Secondly, at the same time, it fosters stakeholders' engagement through integration forums where the EU and Armenian national and local actors can discuss and can exchange. And that's a very important element, dialogue, exchange, because it's the starting point of building systems. And we have funded this activity through the RRF. It's implemented by the local ICMPD office in Yerevan, in Armenia. And we have there a team of four colleagues who are directly working in this initiative, including a counselor as well as a psychologist. And they are providing direct reintegration counseling to returnees. And it's here where the local ownership sets in. So they are operating from the ICMPD referral desk, as we call it, but that desk is hosted within the premises of the Ministry of Labour and Social Affairs. So making their involvement, their contribution as direct as possible. And then there is another project that we're implementing, and that's the Prospect project, which is actually one of our oldest projects, which focuses on integration of migrants with vulnerabilities, specifically potential victims of trafficking. And that is implemented as well by our colleagues in the field, by our Pan-Africa office. And that project benefits greatly from having that expertise, that local team on the ground who has all the information, who knows the context, is aware of the challenges, and can liaise on a daily basis closely with partners such as the Nigerian National Committee for Refugees, Migrants and IDPs, as well as other organizations. These are two examples that show how RRF and an extension also an ICMPD is striving to embed the local ownership within the projects. That it's an advantage to have, because it allows us to respond quickly, to coordinate with the governance, and to make sure that this reintegration support that we are offering is effective and it's tailored to the needs of the local context.
These are all very insightful. We also must acknowledge that the issue is developing. It will continue to evolve, both at the host country level, but also for the countries of origin and us being in the middle of all that. You mentioned earlier that the project is running until 2026. I'm quite curious to know what comes next after that.
It's a very interesting area of work, and a lot is going on, both on the legislative level, but also on operationally, and supporting the member states in the best possible way, including also having strong partnerships with countries of origin. And therein, RRF really is pushing an innovation in return. That's our core value and our unique proposition. We are actively testing new ideas. We're piloting initiatives to fill existing gaps. And those gaps are most of the time articulated by member states, and we're trying to respond to that. I think one of the biggest innovations was what Peter just mentioned about Riyadh. I mean, it's been working for decades on digitalizing integration processes. And if you see the impact, 30,000 cases, it's a huge potential. And we're actually proud, you know, to be the implementing partner, let's say, on behalf of the Commission to support that. What lies ahead of us is a potential new innovation that, well, it's not new, but it's something that I like to call connecting the dots. And which dots exactly? It's the integration support that is provided by the EU or by member states, and the support that is being provided locally in the countries of origin, be it by local actors, governmental organizations, be it by projects funded under development. It's my strong belief that we have to invest it, because integration assistance doesn't stop after 12 months. It takes a long time. Sometimes people need 3 to 5 years to reintegrate, and 12 months of support is hardly sufficient. So if we can make sure that that process is well regulated and that people can be referred to the right bodies, then I think we are there in achieving that goal. So the road is quite ambitious, I must say. It's also challenging, because in every step you take, there are legal considerations, there are human rights considerations. Everything needs to be connected. Everything needs to be well thought through. What comes after 2026 when it comes to the IRF? Again, to reevaluate our unique added value proposition within the whole context of the legal framework that the Commission and the EU in general are shaping.
Yeah, if we talk about the future in Riyadh, I mean, if I look at this tool, it all started very organic, based on that basic insight that something like that was needed to push harmonization cooperation further. Well, we just spoke on where we are now, 30,000 cases. It supports the Frontex EORP, which is basically Europeans' reintegration flagship. In parallel, we also see, and it's an interesting dynamic, that that the EU is putting some thinking in how they can improve and strengthen the current digital infrastructure related to returns. So we'll see what that brings for Riyadh and our role in Riyadh. I can imagine that maybe a more solid institutional structure might be required, given the seriousness, given the volume.
We see a lot of misconception and even disinformation at all levels circulating in public, whether it's within governments or in public discourses on social media. A lot of things that need to be clarified, and I think this is why this conversation is very important. Some of these misconceptions are driven by those with the agenda, including the political ones. And we see this even in conversations that we have with people close to us. So if you would like to change one common misconception about return and reintegration, what would that be?
Return and integration is often seen very negatively as bring persons back home, back on forcibly, but that does need to be like this. The focus is most of the time on voluntary returns, and that's what the strategy, for example, is advocating for. That return, although difficult, can happen in the most dignified way. But at the same time, return itself, it is... it's a very complicated, it's a very sensitive area of work, because it needs coordination at every level. At every stage of the process, you need to have national authorities well-trained and well-coordinated. You need to have cooperation with countries of origin. You need to have strong partners to implement integration assistance. You need trained staff that is aware of fundamental rights aspects. Thus, everything needs to come together to make sure that when a return happens, that it's done in the right way. And things can go wrong. We don't want it to go wrong. And that means everything needs to click together. And then about the reintegration, sometimes it sounds very broad, like you arrive home and then you just go to a social service or you start over. But that's totally not the case. Sometimes it's even more difficult than return. Because here you're looking at long-term perspectives. You're looking at how can we reintegrate. And I touched upon stigmatizations about anxiety, about certain aspects, about the lack of information, ensuring safety, also vulnerabilities. These are all elements that need to be very carefully assessed and dealt with.
And that leads me to my last question. You've both worked in this field for quite a while now, and so you've seen where we used to be and where we are now. And at the same time, also we're looking at what lies ahead. We see that there's a sense of optimism and that there is still much to be done, but also we know that we can do it.
Indeed, we've been working quite some time in this area, and we've seen things changing a lot. Looking 2 decades ago, the landscape looked completely different. There were different perspectives, different focuses. 2 decades ago, it was seen as a purely operational activity and sometimes also a law enforcement task. There was very little, let's say, accent on aspects like reintegration assistance, like digitalization, harmonization of reintegration assistance. That has changed. And it is changing all the time. What we are seeing now is that the EU is completely recalibrating its legal framework. It's partly because the politics change and the citizens of the member states have clearly voiced the need for a different direction. We need to keep on taking important elements like sustainability, voluntary return reintegration, and all the aspects around dignity into account. So that stays. What I also have seen is that the capacities of member states in the past were much more limited than they were today. Until, let's say, 5 years ago, member states were very much reliant on external partners in implementing return and reintegration activities. And that has shifted drastically through these strategies, where we have seen more ownership, and perhaps we can call it ownership, of member states in that process. So there is always something to do. There's always room for innovation. I'm optimistic and I'm very curious to see what's going to happen. I'm very curious to see what 2026 will bring. Perhaps it would be good to have a podcast in 5 years.
Having worked many years in a national administration, Belgian administration, as head of assistant voluntary return, and I basically saw it changing over the years. So when I look back to when I started in this field of activity, return support was limited to a ticket, basically only a ticket. That was everything. That developed into a kind of understanding, a kind of acceptance that returning is more complex than just fetching the logistics, which led then to reintegration support, pilot projects, etc., etc., but developing into what we have now, I think, a EU-wide decent approach towards reintegration support, acknowledging that it's not so easy returning. I think, bon, it doesn't stop there. Mike, you asked about the referral and what is meant by the referral. I think that's like a kind of third stage that we are embarking on now. And also acknowledging that, bon, return, it's more complex than just the logistics. It's more complex than just short-term assistance after arrival. There is more into it, in really kind of like creating sustainable perspectives, really reintegrating somebody back in their society. So I think it's moving slow. Sure, that's because it's complex, but we are making step-by-step progress in developing ever better, ever more sustainable approaches and support strategies for people that have to leave. And I get a lot of motivation out of being, bon, everybody in their own corner, but being a bit of a driver behind this dynamic. And for me, that's the Riad story. For Dries, it's now overall RRF management, but just being in a position whereby you can push that, where you can make change, it's super motivating. Happy to continue for another decade or so.
On that note, this has been very insightful, very, very rich. I would like to thank you both for joining us today. Dries, Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We have just heard from two of our colleagues at ICMPD. Dries Lensen, EU Return and Reintegration Portfolio Manager, and Peter Nealon, RRF Senior Project Manager for the RIA project. They spoke about the issue of return and reintegration, which is far more than a technical or legal issue anymore. This has been another episode of ICMPD's The Migration podcast, where our own experts unpack the issues, the research and the policies, the projects and the partnerships, and the human stories of migration. Follow us on social media and tune into our previous episodes on our website at icmpd.org. Thank you again for listening.